Thank you. Is the mic on? Yeah. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk today. What I would like to discuss is the qualitative features of black hole neutron star mergers when you move from the region of parameter space, which has been most often considered by numerical relativists, to what is considered probably a more astrophysically relevant mass ratio. We first emphasize that all the simulation that I will present here are done within the SPEC collaboration and with, for this particular project, the help of a lot of people here at CETA, Washington State University, Cornell, and Caltech. We've had already a lot of discussion about what is important if you want to properly model black hole neutron star mergers, and in particular the post-merger evolution, which we definitely need to consider all the microphysics, the B fields, and of course, properly model the ejecta. In this talk, I want to mostly focus on what happens right at the time of merger, when we either disrupt the star or the star just plunges into the black hole, and the material from the potentially disrupted star can be divided between some matter flowing into the black hole, an accretion disk, and a tidal tail. And in that part of the evolution, there are really only four main parameters that are to first order important to the evolution, which is the mass ratio of the system, the magnitude of the spin of the black hole and its orientation relative to the orbit and angular momentum, and the compactness of the neutron star in the ratio of its mass to its radius. If we look at a rather simple version of what is the possible parameter space for black hole neutron star in terms of the mass ratio and the compactness of the star, numerical relativity has mostly been focused in this region at low mass ratio. Well, we expect, although there are, of course, large uncertainties when it comes to population synthesis, we expect that field binaries are more likely to be in the higher mass ratio range. So there is a discrepancy here that needs to be addressed, and I'm mostly going to focus here on this talk, on this region here, at higher mass ratio and for the less compact star of the range. And I would like also to emphasize that there is another region which is not really explored, which is the high compactness here, which corresponds to what we would have if we had a more massive star, let's say a two-solar mass star. I'm not going to show simulation about this here, but there is also a region here which is not at all considered by numerical relativity. Of course, there are good reasons to consider the low mass ratio regime too. First, because we cannot rule out that there are binaries there. Second, because most of the interesting physics of a black hole neutron star would occur in that region. And third, because it's actually a lot easier to do computations in the low mass ratio regime and to test your microphysics MHD codes in that region. The simulation that I want to discuss, so are all at mass ratio of 1 to 7, and we will consider variations of the spin of the black hole, its orientation, and of the radius of the neutron star. The main objective being to determine first what is the disk mass at the end of the merger, what mass do you put in the tidal tail, and second, what are gravitational wave effects in those mergers. So basically what you can do fairly reliably with a GR hydro code which doesn't have MHD or neutrinos. First, look at the spin of the black hole. So this is for a fairly large star, 14-kilometer star. So it gives you an upper bound on the kind of disk you can get. It considers a line spin in this case. What we find is that you need very high spin if you want to form any kind of significant remnant. On the left here is the kind of remnant that we like to see if we want to think of black hole neutron stars, potential progenitors for short gamma ray burst. It's a fairly massive disk. About 15% of the mass of the neutron star remains there, as much in the tidal tail, which is not represented here. But that requires a spin of 0.9 on the black hole, initially. If we go down just to a spin of 0.7 for the same fairly large neutron star, you already get this very extended disk of fairly low mass, only a few percent of the mass of the neutron star, which is a lot less promising. And we could get the same, in the case of a mass ratio of 1 to 3, which has been considered more often, we could get the same kind of configuration, same kind of mass, with a non-spinning black hole. Second thing we can look at is what happens if we have precessing binaries. Now, how much misalignment we should allow between the spin of the black hole and the orbital angular momentum is an open question, which was discussed a bit earlier today. In this case, I considered a misalignment up to 60 degrees. The important transition that we notice occurs around a 40-degree misalignment in this case, in which at which point we start losing the formation of an accretion disk. So up to tens of degrees of misalignment, you don't see that much of an effect. At 40 degrees, you still see about 15% of the mass remaining outside of the black hole at late times. If you go to 60 degrees, all you get is that widely precessing tail with differential precession. Of course, even though the disk remains of the same order of magnitude as for non-precessing binaries, there are a lot of additional effects for those precessing binaries, which would be interesting to see. And I think part of that will be the topic of the next talk. Finally, we can look at what happens when you actually look at a more compact star. And if we move from a 14-kilometer star, which was at 30% mass at the black hole at late time, to a big, probably more realistic 12-kilometer star, we get to about 10% of the mass of the neutron star remaining outside at late time. And this is a picture of the merger. You can see that clearly there's not much disruption. Everything just falls into the black hole. And actually, it's pretty surprising to me that even one-third of this mass here, which is about 30% left outside the black hole, even one-third of this mass here managed to stay out of the black hole and form an accretion disk. And if we went to about an 11-kilometer star, we predict that we wouldn't actually see any disk at all anymore. We can try to make a bit more quantitative predictions and look at all the simulations that have been done recently by Masaru Shibata's group in Kyutoku et al., by the Illinois group in Etienne et al., and by your own collaboration, and try to get an estimate of what the remnant mass would be at late time across the entire simulated parameter space. I want to emphasize that this is the remnant mass, so it combines the disk mass, the tail mass, and the ejected mass all together. And then, you know, so it gives you upper bounds on everything in a way. And you can get fairly good estimates of that just by looking at the combination of the tail disruption radius, that is the point at which you expect the star to disrupt, and the innermost circular orbit of the black hole. This is fairly intuitive, is that if your tail disruption radius is way out of your ISCO, well, your star will disrupt and you can form a massive disk. If your tidal disruption radius is way inside the ISCO, you won't get any disk at all. But it's surprising that it can actually predict the result of numerical relativity within a fairly good accuracy, a few percent of the mass of the neutron star, at least for mass from not up to 20% of the mass of the neutron star or so. And I'm not considering here precessing binaries, also in the next talk, we'll discuss that, I think. You can get this kind of predictions across the. So this is for all 1 to 7 mass ratio. And the main thing that we can see is that in most of the range of values that we have been told is most favorable, let's say 11 to 13 kilometer here, you need very high black hole spin if you want to form any kind of remnants. If you want, let's say, a 10% remnant, you are in at least 0.8 to 0.9 black hole spin. So you really need a quasi-extremal spin if you want any kind of interesting results. You can play the same game, of course, looking at how it depends on the mass ratio here, so the mass ratio on the x-axis and the spin on the y-axis here for a fairly standard neutron star. And you find that even at a lower mass ratio, but still fairly realistic, you still need a spin of order of 0.8. If you want a 15 solar mass black hole, then you really need an extremal spin. Let me switch gear a little bit and talk about gravitational wave for the system. For all those simulations, we have gravitational wave of with about 15 to 20 cycles, depending on the spin of the black hole, more for the larger spins. The numerical error for those gravitational waves is of order of a few tenths of a radiant during Jean spiral, significantly more during merger. And there is an extrapolation error just by the fact that we extract the wave at finite radius and then extrapolate them, which is probably about 0.05 radiant, less than 0.1 radiant. Let's first look at the effect of the spin of the black hole. So this is not overly surprising. It's fairly similar to what we find in the binary black hole, the kind of effect that was described by Jeffrey in his talk. That the main observable effect in those waves is just the orbital hang-up. That is, the higher spins in spiral more slowly. There is also some effect of the disruption of the star in that the red curve, which is a spin of 0.9, actually disrupts, and so you have a smoother transition towards ring down, while the green curve, which nearly which keeps nearly no mass outside of the black hole, the star is immediately accreted onto the black hole as a shape more reminiscent of what happens in binary black hole. That is, yeah, Nico. A shape more reminiscent of what happens in binary black hole, that is a direct transition to a sharp ring dawn at merger. More interesting, maybe, in terms of gravitational wave is what happened when we look at the dependence on the equation of state. So here I show on the left the gravitational wave for the spin aligned 0.9, a mass ratio of 1 to 7 still, with the 12-kilometer star and the 14-kilometer star, 14-kilometer star in red. You can see that up to about one cycle before the larger star starts disrupting, the two waveforms agree very well. They are matched, of course, in this region, but still, the phase difference between the two waveforms is actually below the estimated numerical error for the simulations. And only really at the very end, can you see the difference, which comes mostly from the fact that one star disrupts and the other one nearly doesn't. So it will be very difficult to actually measure any kind of phase difference during the inspiral of those systems if this is confirmed. This is not overly surprising. Justin, in a talk yesterday, showed the same effect but for 1-to-2 mass ratio, and we could see some phase difference, but not much. And the scaling of the phase difference due to the equation of state is like 1/(q^5), I believe. And so the fact for 1-to-7 mass ratio, which is probably more realistic for black hole neutron star, we don't see any of this is not that surprising. We can, however, see, of course, the difference in the spectrum, in the cutoff of the spectrum at high frequency, with the disrupting star cutting at about 1 kHz and the non-disrupting star cutting at 2 kHz. But that's already a challenging frequencies to reach for LIGO unless we have a very loud event. Also, an important point to notice is that this disruption of the this difference in the waveform mostly occurs due to the disruption of the star. And so, if you have a configuration in which the black hole neutron star does not disrupt, which is in the case of a 1-to-7 mass ratio, actually a large part of the parameter space, it is it might be quite challenging to see any difference due to the equation of state. There will probably still be some effect of the fact that the neutron star is actually distorted and falls into the black hole, not as just one spherical object. But it will be a lot more challenging than this, which is actually, if any, the most favorable case for us, in which we actually see the transition from no disruption to disruption. So let me conclude by saying that what we find is that disk formation in the case of those higher mass ratio, 5-to-10 mass ratio, is only possible if you have either slightly larger neutron star than what you might expect, or quasi-extremal spin, by which I mean at least 0.9, 0.95 spin, which is not impossible because we just don't know what the distribution of spin is, but certainly limits your possibilities. The equation of state on the waveform is fairly small, especially during its spiral. The main effect is the cutoff due to disruption or non-disruption of the star. And finally, we obtained mass predictions, which are available in most of the astrophysical range of parameters from simulations from all the numerical relativity group, which have done black hole neutron star. Okay, thank you.
Questions for Francois?
I see on your graphs that you have a limiting mass for the disk of 0.2 solar masses between a disk that forms short GRBs and not. I wonder what is the basis of this line?
I'm not putting a curves about 0.2 is because I do not trust the model above 0.2. There aren't many simulations which have that high of a remnant mass. And so I wouldn't trust the fit in that region. All I say is that in that region, you have a large remnant, larger than 0.2. I don't know where the threshold is to form a gamma ray burst, and I don't think anyone knows.
I saw that you know something that that nobody else knew, and I wanted to hear about it.
Sadly, no.
Just want to remark that the energy that you see in a short gamma ray burst, the isotropic equivalent energy, is of the order of at most 10 to the 50 erx, maybe even less. So there is a lot of room for efficiency, and you can have much smaller disks. So.
No, I perfectly agree with that. I think in the region in between, in which we actually have predictions, there is a possibility of a gamma ray burst if you happen to have the right evolution afterwards. All I say is that that's a region in which you have a high mass disk, and I don't know how much.
Of course, the larger the disk, the more likely that you can generate something.
You could get something interesting at lower mass too. That's certain. Yes. The one thing I know is that in the red region you won't get anything.
Well, on the other side of the, on the other end of the mass spectrum, you don't. A light mass disk, like 10 to the minus 3 even, solar masses, could be sufficient to power a burst. So, you don't. It would be interesting to see how the mass grades in your the figure where you had the mass range for the disks from 0 to 0.2. How does that distribute when you go down to 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3 solar masses for the disk? The distinction is also interesting between what you call disk and tail, and that's also,
yeah,
of course,
so
that's
I think
of course
I think
very
that's
important.
Something that we have to clarify in the future.
But you don't need probably 20% of a solar mass to power a short JRB.
No. Okay. The question is how does disk evolve? I think you need some kind of, you need the properties of disk to be right so that it evolves into eventually a short JRB. And
So you have two timescales. Now the viscous timescale, that depends strongly on the mass of the disk, but your main energy reservoir is the spin of the black hole. So the disk only serves to anchor the magnetic field, and remember you only need a 10 to the minus 3 solar mass disk to anchor a 10 to the 15 Gauss field. So, and then sort of Blanchard's and Hayek, you know, most of the energy is coming from the spin of the black hole. So.
Any other questions? Let's thank Francois.